Every seminarian has to take a course in Christian ethics. And if it's taught in the right way, it's the point in a seminary education where you have the biggest fights with your classmates. It's really quite fun to duke it out with your friends and colleagues on these massive issues, especially once you realize they're all heretics. And maybe you are too. One of the books we read in my ethics class was a book about the writings of Charles Taylor, one of the most preeminent philosophers of our day. And I chose my words carefully there. I did say a book about the writings of Charles Taylor, because thankfully our professor took some pity on us that semester. Taylor's work is dense, and even reading a synopsis of it presents a hearty challenge to any student of philosophy, which I might add, I am not. But I remember thinking when I saw this reading assignment in the syllabus, when am I ever going to use this in parish ministry? Lo and behold, when I got to my first church as clergy, I discovered that they had a philosophy book group, and they were reading none other than Charles Taylor's book, A Secular Age. So touche, Charles Taylor, touche. Taylor's writing actually has a lot of important implications for our lives. In A Secular Age, Taylor presents a very important question about our modern life. He examines the idea of secularism and its skyrocketing rise in prominence throughout the 20th and 21st centuries, a rise that is often directly opposed to the idea of religion, even more than that, opposed to the idea of God in the first place. Taylor asks the question, why was it virtually impossible not to believe in God in, say, 1500 in our Western society, while in the year 2000, many of us find this not only easy, but even inescapable? And so then he goes about making his case for why this idea of secularism is so popular, for why religious institutions have a hard time combating secularism, and why ultimately both secularists and religious folk alike are often wrong in the way we perceive the world. All of this comes down to a central claim that is paramount to our understanding of God, which is that there is no such thing as secular. The idea that there is anything removed from God, anything not part of God's reach, anything outside the realm of God's understanding is simply false. Taylor points out that both secularism and religion fall prey to the same trap of a closed view of the world. Secularists may deny God's existence and push for world order based on certain morals and standards, but such a stance still falls prey to zealotry and to definitions of good and bad based on one culture's understanding, often in opposition to and with superiority over another culture. Once you get into the question of defining morals, it's a tricky and nuanced debate. What counts as good and bad is often subjective. And religion has the same issue. In the quest to answer that same question, about good and evil, about morals and standards, religion has the potential to create rules and regulations based more on culture than on God. Such rules become rigid and stagnant and likely don't present a great picture of a loving God. What is missing in both accounts is transcendence, a quality that helps us escape our closed takes on the world and open ourselves up to actual reality. So look, we'll let the philosophers battle it out over Taylor's arguments, but I think we can say for us as Christians living in this age, we are firmly in Taylor's camp. We are right to reject the idea of secularism. We are right to reject the idea that there is anything not part of God. So when we're talking about transcendence, opening us up to reality, we're talking about God's reality. We're talking about being open to the reality of God's world. To even have a debate about what is secular and what is religious, what isn't, misses the point. The reality is that God is, period. And so leaving the debate for the philosophers and choosing a side, we're still left with the nagging question of application. Do we live in the world as if we believe God is fully present? Do we live our lives expecting to find God in everything? Do our actions match the belief that all the world is sacred to God? And therefore should be sacred to us? We likely do not. But that's the beauty of transcendence, of seeing beyond ourselves and experiencing the call to something deeper, the call to God's reality of goodness. Our readings this morning point to two examples which show that the failure to grasp the transcendent reality of God is not merely a modern problem. In our reading from Ecclesiastes, we hear the author calling out a vain and self-absorbed world. Vanity of vanities, says the teacher. All is vanity. The beautiful nature of this section comes from the wisdom literature in our biblical canon. And it gives example after example of the vain ways we deceive ourselves. It says, I hated all my toil in which I had toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to those who come after me. And who knows whether they will be wise or foolish? This also is vanity. To be clear, the author is calling vain his own reaction to having the work of his life handed over to someone else after death, for which he will have no control. Rather than a joyous reaction to the transcendence of his life's work, he is filled instead with hate. Such a human emotion there, and I think the perfectionist in me feels seen by this. Think of all the things we work on, toil over, the possessive nature we take of our tasks, our belongings, our identities that we've crafted. What's the point of them? As the author suggests, they are in vain if they are not for God. And the author goes on, clearly perplexed by this realization. He says, so I turned and gave my heart up to despair concerning all the toils of my labors under the sun. Because sometimes one who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave all to be enjoyed by another who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. It's interesting to bring in not just the material things we tend to hoard, but also the intellectual insights we've gained through life. All vanity, if not for us giving them over to God. Similarly, in our reading from Luke, we get a lesson on greed. Jesus tells a parable of a rich man whose land has produced abundantly, so much, in fact, that he decides to tear down his current stores and build new ones to hold the excess. This he does while saying to himself, I will say to my soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry. Which certainly sounds tempting, does it not? Luke's gospel often has a harsh critique of money and material possessions, and so we get a typical Lucan response from God to this rich man. You fool! This very night, your life is being demanded of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be? All this to say, if our possessions are inwardly focused, then they have the effect of closing our worldview. If our possessions are part of what God is doing in the world, well, then all is not in vain. But it's bigger than possessions. With these two readings, we really see the fullness of life on display. Luke speaks of our possessions and our wealth. Ecclesiastes speaks of our work, our toil, our skills. It speaks of our thoughts, our ideas, our hopes, our dreams. And both passages tell us that in the true reality of the world, these things that make up our life do not actually belong to us. They belong to God. So what would it mean to use these things that make up our lives in a way that cherishes them as the gifts they truly are? We could look at a lot of examples that answer that question. The monetary examples are relatively low-hanging fruit. I think we can all think of ways to use the monetary wealth in our communities in ways that respect the dignity of every human being and sustain and renew the life of the earth. And I hope we will do those things. But we have wealth beyond our monetary assets as well. It's what we've been doing with the Holy Listening process here over the past year, attempting to identify the community assets that God has placed among us. Think of all the things that make you the person that you are. Think of all the unique things that you bring that seem completely normal to you, but to someone else is extraordinary. We need that. God's world needs that, which is why God has given it to you in the first place, so that you can be the bearer of God's goodness. So yes, at this very moment, your life is being demanded of you. But not because it's at threat, but because it doesn't actually belong to you. Your life and all the things that give it meaning are all gifts that are meant to enlighten and deepen the fullness of God's world. This is what it means to transcend. This is what I mean when I say there is no such thing as a secular world. There is no such thing as something that God is not a part of. May we start to live our lives in ways that bear witness to God's goodness written into the fabric of creation. May we use the gifts of our lives in a way that transcends our own understanding and gives in to God's demands of grace, of mercy, and of love. Amen.